You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by FitzDares, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by Thoroughbred Racing Commentaries Global Rankings. Good morning, welcome to the show. Wednesday, June the 29th, dull, dreary day here in TW11, bit of drizzle in the air as well. If you were with us yesterday, you'll have heard me discussing the gambling review and the imminent white paper with Neil Channing. There was some contention in racing whether this white paper would appear before or after the parliamentary recess on July the 22nd. The Times has gone with the former on the front page today, saying Boris Johnson poised to announce curbs on online gambling in an effort to stem the catastrophic, in inverted commas, impact of addiction on people's lives. Ministers will publish a review of the 17-year-old gambling legislation amid concerns that it's been rendered outdated by the explosion in popularity of online betting. And political editor Stephen Swinford goes on to outline much of what we brought you yesterday on this podcast. The one significant difference being that the Whitehall leak to the Times appears to suggest that advertising on football shirts has been significantly rowed back on, but there'll be a backlash, and you'd have thought that that might go round again. Anyway, it doesn't look as though we were too far from the mark on the podcast yesterday. News on the track, or closer to the track, very elegant, the Australian superstar. She's set to make a European debut, according to trainer Francis Graffard, in the Prix Rothschild at Deauville over a mile. We still await news whether Royal Ascot heroine In Spiral will go to the Falmouth Stakes next week. We suspect that she will, though no decision has been made yet formally on who is going to ride her in the wake of the split or sabbatical between Dettori and Gosden. That's still under discussion, we gather. And Bay Bridge, the rider for the Eclipse, we've been assuming was Ryan Moore until Richard Kingscote was jocked up on the horse. But we now gather, courtesy of The Sun, that this is Kingscote just waiting on whether Ryan Moore is going to be claimed by Aidan O'Brien for the ride on that. All that to come a little bit later on with Jane Mangan. First of all, though, let's head you back to the weekend and that farce in Ireland with Ross Carberry, the third-placed filly in the Pretty Polly Stakes, being demoted because her rider failed to weigh in correctly. Paddy Toomey joins me on the line now, her trainer. He also won the race, of course, with La Petite Coco. Paddy, you've had a bit of time for the dust to settle. What are you going to do?
So the deadline for lodging an appeal against what happened to Ross Carberry on Sunday was 5 o'clock yesterday evening, so my solicitors lodged an appeal, applied for an appeal process there yesterday afternoon.
So the IHRB told us that there would be a referral hearing. Is an appeals process separate to that referral hearing?
Yeah, well, I think that if we are to, if we have any chance to be reinstated in third place, where I think we rightfully belong, the only way of doing that is through the appeal process.
So my read of it is,
if we passed 5 o'clock yesterday, that option would have been gone.
So you have to go through the motions and you have to appeal. Now, because she Absolutely. Did, because she carried 9 stone 7, and it may have been completely not your fault or Wayne Lorden's fault, I can't see a way objectively of how you get it back. That's just the way I'm looking at it objectively. But what I am wondering is, if you go through those motions and you don't have any success, whether you can then consider some sort of civil action. Is that an avenue you'd go down?
Absolutely. Look, it's an error on the part of the IHRB. It's basically they're not fit for purpose on the day. They sent the man out to racing. They gave me a saddle. They null and voided the horse's chance from the minute I picked the saddle up from the jockey after the clerk of the scales okayed him to go. Philly's race was over. You know, she never really ran after that, you know. So,
and as you say, your owner has stumped up €30,000, which is a not inconsiderable amount of money. Just going back to actually how this happened, there's all sorts of suggestions as to what it might have been. It might just be worth you clarifying exactly from your position that sequence of events, just to leave nobody in any doubt that you could have dropped a weight cloth, or you could have, you know, you could have mislaid something, or in your hurry you could have got the saddles mixed up or anything like that?
That's certainly not the case. As I described extensively there, it's written in the press, and I talked to you on Sunday. The sequence of events, as I outlaid on the day, was what happened. Whether the clerk of the scales made the error himself or the computer made it is irrelevant. An employee of the IHRB has made the mistake. It looks a very archaic system where, obviously, it's coming up in pounds, stone and pounds on the race card, which is an obsolete system. We should have a metric system. And when he's weighing out the jockey, then it comes up on the screen in pounds only. So there's loads of room for error when a human being is there and it's 9 stone 12 and it's 138.1 pounds. I mean, if somebody makes any mistake, they can make it. It should be in kilos, where it will come up, the jockey's weight in kilos, and the scales would reflect that in kilos. We live in 2022, we live in Europe, we have a metric system for weighing things, and I think that the IHRB are, you know, operating in a bygone age.
And in terms of the filly's own future, where's the next opportunity for her to get some Group 1 placed form, do you think?
Sure, I guess now that she's Group 1 placed, she has a Lily Langley entry, which is Group 2, but she has a Yorkshire Oaks entry, and, you know, we're just going to have to follow the programme. But you know, there is a chance she might never be Group 1 placed again, and that will have a huge bearing on her future.
I heard a few people saying, "God, that Paddy Toomey's a miserable bugger. He just won a Group 1 and he wasn't very excited after La Petite Coco won." I think somebody had just whispered something in your ear just before you spoke to me, hadn't they?
Yeah, you know, I just as we were talking, you know, I heard the klaxon and I knew what was going on, and I was quite upset because I saw the error being made, you know, retrospectively. When I heard the klaxon, I heard it, I knew that there was confusion beforehand, and I had a feeling it wasn't going to end well.
Yeah, so you were quite worried about it. I mean, you've had a chance to reflect on the win of your filly as well, and Billy Lee's been talking about it quite a bit since. And this Arc de Triomphe plan sounds a very exciting one. Is that's the target, and you just work back from there?
Look, I gave her the entry there in the spring, and La Petite Coco is a highly talented filly. She's never put a foot wrong, you know, since she came to me, and she keeps her best work for the track. In the morning, she just goes through the motions, and you know, but every time she gets in a battle, you know, she's hard to get by. She's hard to deal with for other horses, and you know, she's honest and she's straightforward and she's talented, and a mile and a half on easier ground, I think, is probably her optimum thing. And, you know, she hasn't raced against colts. She has actually in a winner's race. I apologize. She's raced against colts once in a winner's race. But on the whole, at stakes level, she has not raced against colts. So that will be something that later in the year that, you know, if she continues to progress like she has done, that I'd like to explore.
And it's not as though you're a Johnny Come Lately. Everyone knows you're a very good trainer now with an extremely high strike rate. But how important is she as a marquee horse to really launch you on that international stage, and to sort of put your name in lights to people who, you know, who haven't been following the stable that closely?
Look, I think she's very important. I think every trainer needs every good horse that comes their way. You have to be lucky enough that they come through the doorway, and when they do come through the doorway, you know, you're privileged to have them, and they give you exposure on an international stage. And look, myself and Billy and everybody here enjoy competing at the highest level. There's a great thrill racing on big days, and I'd like to do more of it.
Paddy Toomey there. Jane Mangan is with me this morning. Jane, we knew Paddy wasn't very happy, but we've got a clearer sense now of the direction of travel here.
For sure. Number one, it must be just leave such a sour taste after he winning his first Group 1. That should be a day of elation, a night of celebration, and all those different emotions you go through as somebody who's basically self-made and reached the pinnacle of their career, only to literally in a matter of moments have it taken away, and not taken away in that the Group 1 winner doesn't stand, because of course La Petite Coco is our Pretty Polly winner of 2022. But the Ross Carberry ding dong, when the klaxon sounded at the Curragh, I think we all turned our heads. We thought there's no interference in running. We were wondering what this weight issue might be. And legitimately, you automatically assume that there's been a fault, whether it be with the saddling procedures or somewhere between weighing out and weighing back in. But never in my lifetime have I come across a situation that happened on Sunday where it seems the IHRB scales or the clerk of the scales was negligent. Now, it would have to happen in a Group 1. You know, all the races that are run throughout the year, and of course it would have to happen to a filly in a Group 1, just has to be the most important of all. And I'm not surprised that Paddy and his owners, Robert Moran, have decided to take this course of action, because it's a huge blow to them. It's a huge value for the filly. Not only we're talking about the 30,000 euro supplementary fee, the prize money of 30,000 as well for third place, but how do you put a value on Group 1 place on a filly's pedigree? It's difficult to know where to even draw the line, because it's not just Ross Carberry's pedigree, but it's her mother, Rose Rise, the breeder of Ross Carberry, the people who have branches of that family. It's a never-ending story, this, and I'll be following it closely.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's going to be unlikely, as I said. He has to hope that he has some sort of way of getting his third place back on appeal. He doesn't, to my mind, because the filly carried 9-7 and she should have been carrying 9-12. That would be manifestly unfair on all the others. But you do think that they've got to have grounds, if they can prove that it wasn't Paddy or Wayne Lorden at fault, and they assure us that it wasn't, then they've surely got to have some reasonable claim for civil case and compensation.
Yes, if they can, I would imagine, sue for damages and get awarded accordingly. But their legal team will be busy trying to put a value on this, because if you take, for instance, Turret Rocks, who won the Pretty Polly a couple of years ago, her first foal, Son of Kingman, Age of Kings, he went to the sales as a yearling and made 1.1 million. Did he make that value because his mother was Group 1 placed, or because she was a group winner? Did he make that value because he was by Kingman? And if you follow up to last year, it was won by Kay and Pepper. She went to the sales, she made 2 million. Did she make 2 million because she was Group 1 placed, or did she make 2 million because she was a Group 2 winner? It's, you know, we can throw out all these valuations, but I'm sure his legal team will be on it. And if they are going to put a valuation forward, I'd imagine it won't be on the conservative side.
Now, talking of the value of pedigrees, there was a very interesting piece in the Thoroughbred Daily News yesterday. Emma Berry interviewed Bjorn Nielsen, the owner breeder of Stradivarius. The headline that's been taken by just about everyone is Nielsen talking about Dottori's ride on the horse, Asker. You can understand that. But to my mind, Jane, the interesting part of this article was actually what Bjorn Nielsen wants to do with the horse at stud, which is to stand him as a stallion. He realizes that his commercial appeal is limited, such as the way things are now. But he said there are a couple of studs that are interested. He thinks he's going to have to support him with quite a few of his own mares that he's either got or that he acquires. And he has said that he will only cover flat mares, unlike most stayers on the flat. He's no interest in covering National Hunt mares to try and build his book up. How do you read this? And has he got any shot of making Stradivarius a success as a stallion, in your opinion?
He has, because he's being realistic and he knows that it'll be an uphill battle. He knows that he will probably have to keep 100% equity himself, because nobody else will be enticed to invest. He knows that he's had limited interest from flat studs. He initiated that, or he inferred that he had offers from France and Germany. None from Ireland were mentioned in this piece. And that he had some from the UK, but he'd almost certainly have to maintain 100% ownership. He quite rightfully outlined the attractiveness. While the commercial side of it, and he's realistic as to what the modern market wants, he said soundness and durability, temperament, combined with ability is exactly the attributes that this horse has that people should be breeding for. But he understands why people are not doing that. And if you look at what, so this horse has stayed in training as an 8-year-old. If you look at what he's actually earned as a racehorse alone, so everybody knows the figures of 20 wins from 34 runs, 7 of them at Group 1 level, but 3.3 million in prize money plus 2 Wetherby's Hamilton Stayers bonuses. So he's earned 5.3 million on the track, which is extremely rare for a horse racing almost exclusively in Britain. And he points to the fact that one of the leading influences in the world, not just in Europe or Japan, but in the world, is Deep Impact, who won all his 12 races from 10 furlongs to 2 miles. So it's a fashionable market. He probably understands, or he seems to understand, that those who will be breeding to Stradivarius won't be breeding for the sales ring, that they will be breeding to race and hopefully produce future Stradivariuses. But to get a quality book and to get a big book, he's probably going to have to attract the owner breeders. Because if you and me are trying to breed to make a profit at the sales ring is a caustic place to be if your sire is winning over 2.5 miles.
Well, it's not so much that he's winning over 2.5 miles. It's more the fact that he couldn't win a top flight race at 1.5 miles. Isn't that the truth? Japan revere stamina perhaps over any other major breeding nation, and look how well they've done because of it. And I'm fully in admiration of Bjørn Nielsen's loyalty to his horse and all the qualities that he describes. But even a horse like Yates, admittedly, who's made most of his money covering National Hunt mares, he was able to win a Coronation Cup over 1.5 miles. Order of St. George, third in an arc. This horse hasn't really got any form over even 1.5 miles. So that lack of, I'm not saying he lacked speed, because he's got a turn of foot. We know that because we see it, and you know, the sectional times show it. But he doesn't have on his CV a notable performance, even in the realms of what we would call middle distance. And I can't therefore see how he is in any way appealing to any flat breeder in reality. I think it's probably right. He's not that suitable as a National Hunt stallion because he doesn't have the size. He's a horse who connections say wants quickish ground. So that's not ideal either. And you know, National Hunt people like big bay horses, and they're not going to get a big bay horse by Stradivarius. So I don't know. I'm in full admiration of what Bjørn Nielsen's trying to achieve. I just don't know how he's going to achieve it.
I get the lack of 1.5 miles class form, and I think when he tried to run, and you know, when he tried him in the arc, it was a messy arc. He was 7 behind Sutsas.
Yeah,
he
went and it was slow, it was a bog. But I'm even looking at his. He was well beaten when they tried to run him over 1.5 miles in the Jockey Club Stakes at Newmarket.
But it's funny, you can't legitimately say he's slow, because I can't remember in my lifetime a horse that can turn it on 2 furlongs down after running 2 miles and leave everything else. It's not like those stairs you see where they grind the opposition into submission by just burning them off. This horse had that change of gear, but it's almost refreshing that as an owner breeder, Bjorn has taken such a strong viewpoint on this, because it's only last Sunday or last Saturday I was trying to defend why the Irish Derby should remain at 1.5 miles on our national broadcaster, because you know, Ireland in particular has been at the forefront of the breeding industry because we've been excellent at producing brilliant middle distance horses, and just because the market is suggesting that we should be getting quicker, should we change everything that we're good at to facilitate that market? So I admire the man for what he's trying to do. I'm not going to say he's going to be successful in his endeavours, but I'll be interested to see how it goes.
Yeah, it would be wonderful if he could produce a top-notch Group 1 flat horse by Stradivarius. It would send a great message, for sure. I wish him well with that project. And on a related theme, Jane, there's an equally interesting piece by Martin Stevens in today's Racing Post, talking to Dr. Emmeline Hill, the well-known geneticist and fertility researcher in thoroughbred racehorses, talking about the negative impact of inbreeding. If you were listening to the podcast yesterday, you'll have heard Imad Al-Sagar, the breeder of the Prix de Diane winner Nashua, saying how he was trying to maintain rarefied bloodlines in his pedigrees to try and strengthen his breed. And it seems from what Emmeline Hill has researched that he's got the right idea.
It is proven from this study that horses with the highest levels of DNA measured inbreeding, as opposed to what might be summarized from a tabulated pedigree, had a 13% lower probability of ever competing in a race. It has also long been known that inbreeding has a negative consequence for an animal, as harmful mutations can accumulate in the genome. That has been shown in other species, such as cattle, where inbreeding has unfavorably affected traits such as fertility, growth, and production, and in dogs, where inbreeding has led to chronic health conditions.
So Dr. Emmeline Hill is with me now. Dr. Hill, the one question I was really interested in is, if I look at a pedigree and I see you've got Sadler's Wells, three back in the top generation and two back in the bottom generation, and I think, well, that horse is more inbred than horse B, who's got relatives further back in the pedigree. It seems that your research doesn't necessarily say that's the case, or there's actually a scientific differentiation. Just, can you just explain a bit more for the layman?
Yeah, sure. So when we look at inbreeding measured from the DNA of a horse, we're actually looking at the shared parts of the genome, or the parts of the genome that have been identically inherited from the sire and the dam. And then we add up all of those bits that are shared identically inherited from the sire and the dam to get a percentage level of similarity. And that's what we call inbreeding, genomic inbreeding. That's different from pedigree inbreeding, and we've seen that. We've looked at the correlation, the relationship between pedigree estimated levels of inbreeding and genomic inbreeding, and it doesn't always correlate very well. In fact, it doesn't correlate very well at all. And the reason for that is that pedigrees nowadays are quite similar. We don't have the same resolution that we might have had back in the day, where there was wide variation in the gene pool, or wide variation in pedigrees. And we know in the thoroughbred that there's a very high level of genetic relatedness. And so that, I suppose, that lack of resolution now is seen in this, difference in the actual measured inbreeding level that we can see in the DNA and what is assumed from the pedigree.
So in order for us to try and breed a racehorse that has that percentage chance of making it to the racecourse, that stronger percentage chance of making it to the racecourse because they are physically more robust and less compromised by genomic inbreeding, does that really necessitate a proper DNA study of each and every prospective parent?
Well, unless you have very, very clear outcrosses, the stallions that are very clear outcrosses, in other words, they're, you know, really known to be very different. Yes, it will be challenging to do that without the genetics part of it, because it just gives you that much finer resolution that that you can't get from the pedigree. So the best way to examine relatedness between animals is to look at the relatedness on the basis of a DNA sample, and the best way to measure inbreeding in an individual to assess its potential for racing or viability for racing is from the DNA. So really, I think what we're seeing now is that this limitation of reduction in the variation in sire lines is really having an effect on that. But it's not impossible. It's not impossible to use the pedigree to give you some level of an indicator, but really the best way to evaluate relatedness, to look for outcross stallions, to reduce that inbreeding in potential progeny, and produce more viable horses for racing, is to use genetic information.
So I spoke to Imad Al-Sagar, as I was saying, yesterday on the podcast, and he was saying he was trying to maintain some of those older sire lines in his pedigrees for this very reason. I mean, you'd say that's a good idea. That's the first starting point.
Absolutely. I think maintaining any variation in the gene pool now is critically important. I mean, we've seen the trends over the years, increase in inbreeding. Up until now, we didn't know if that trend in increasing inbreeding was positive, negative, or having no effect at all. But now, with our new research, we've shown that actually higher levels of inbreeding does have a negative effect on the breed, not only in the population as a whole, but on individual animals. And that is, I suppose, a critical factor in thinking about individual animal health and welfare. It's also critical to consider it in the context of economic returns for breeders, because, you know, every breeder wants to breed a horse that can actually race. But in, I suppose, in the broader scheme of things, in terms of the sort of overall population health for the future, the genetic health of the population for the future, we now know that actually if efforts to lower inbreeding and maintain genetic diversity in the population should have a positive impact.
All right, continuing our build-up to Saturday's Coral Eclipse at Sandown Park. Jane, I've been speculating this week as to whether Ryan Moore would end up on Bay Bridge. Richard Kingscote has now been jocked up on the horse in the papers, but he explained to Callum Jameson of The Sun last night, who tweeted, that he was on standby just in case Ryan Moore was claimed to ride by Aidan O'Brien. It's still not confirmed that Kingscote will definitively ride, and we don't know whether Aidan's actually going to run any of his three horses or not. So still Ryan Moore's ride, unless Aidan asks him to ride one of his.
Yeah, Richard Kingscote is a very understanding guy, and he knows his position with Sir Michael Stout. I sat with him on your show the morning after he won the Epsom Derby, and he quite easily and fluently said that Desert Crown is Ryan Moore's ride unless he's unavailable. You know, that's the kind of understanding that he has, and Aidan O'Brien hasn't made his final decisions, and as he tends to do, he's going to wait until the very last minute to see whether he'll have a runner in the Coral Eclipse. I would expect him to have something. I would imagine Stone Age might be that runner. They mentioned dropping him back in trip after he was well beaten at Epsom, but I think it's not about that horse this weekend. I think it's about Vedeni, and Jean-Claude Rouget has supplemented him for the race, and it's a wonderful addition to the race. I saw somewhere last night that the Aga Khan has not had a winner on British turf since Harzan's Epsom Derby win in 2016. Now, he hasn't had many runners, if any, but Vedeni looked really awesome in the Prix de Jockey Club, and with Sumi on board, he'd be very hard to beat. But throw in Mishriff, the heavyweight champion, throw in Native Trail, the three-year-old, and Baybridge, fresh from Ascot as well. This has all the ingredients to be a vintage renewal.
Well, this time last year, we were fully expecting Mishriff to win the Coral Eclipse, and in the end, he needed the run and was beaten by St. Mark's Basilica. This time round, in spite of his extraordinarily illustrious career, which includes that romp in last year's Judmont International, he seems to be the forgotten horse. He hasn't run since disappointing in this year's Saudi Cup. His regular rider is David Egan. David, tell me a little bit about his preparation over the last couple of weeks. I gather you've been riding him this morning.
Yeah, I sat him this morning and I rode him twice last week. He's seems in good form. He's obviously had a nice break since Saudi, and his build-up has been sort of pretty smooth, and he's in good form leading up to the race for Saturday, for sure.
What did you make of the Saudi run? We went there with great expectations because he'd won the race the previous year. What went wrong?
Yeah, he didn't... obviously very disappointing. He was beaten a long, long way out. The pace was obviously pretty fierce early doors, and probably sat, possibly in hindsight, probably handier than maybe we should have been, considering there's such a strong pace when you see the winner coming from out the back in 16 wide like it was. But look, he didn't run his race for whatever reason. I know Mr. Gosden said he might have got a clump of dirt down his airwaves, and that's why he stopped. So look, for whatever reason he didn't run his race, I knew it wasn't him, so I stood up on him and looked after him. Look, there was prize money down to 10th place, but it's all about the future with this horse, and it's not all about one day. He's got a long season ahead, and hopefully because of that he can bounce back, and we know he can. He's bounced back many times before, and I'm sure he can do it again.
How does he feel to you to ride at the moment? Does he feel any different to how he did 12 months ago, 24 months ago? Does he seem to be moving well and in good nick?
Yeah, he's in great nick. Yeah, you have to think now he's obviously taken on these young, mature and three-year-olds. He's a five-year-old colt at the top level. You don't get many of them around kind of these days. And physically, he's at his physical peak now, I would say. He's thick. He's a lovely mover. He's a horse with a very noticeable head carriage, which probably makes him stand out to the rest of the field when he's going in his races. He's got that low sort of nearly hitting the grass with his nose. So, no, he's in great form. And hopefully this run in the Eclipse, which is a very, very strong race, as we all know, but it'd be nice to see him back at the top level and see how he fares out with the young three-year-olds coming through, along with the sort of the top-class individuals in, you know, Bay Bridge and Real World and Alan Carr and the likes. It'd be nice to see them sort of come up against them again.
I mean, John Gosden last year, he made no secret of the fact it was a building block, and really they were trying to get him to peak for the Judmonts International, which happened, and it worked, and he ran a fine race in the King George as well. Do you see it very much following the same pattern, or do you think he is readier this time to perform nearer to his best on Saturday?
Yeah, I felt he did, as said, after last year's run in the Eclipse, he did get pretty tired up there. He travelled into the race like the winner almost, and had St. Mark's Basilica sort of under pressure first, and for a few strides, myself especially, thought it was sort of our race to win, and just that last furlong and a half up the hill just caught him out, eventually finishing third, obviously. But I think this year he's had a nice preparation into the race. He's been working well, he seems fit and well, so obviously you'd expect him to take a step forward for that, but he definitely seems as good as we can get him at this stage of the season, for sure.
Thanks, David. Thanks to all my guests today. Jane Mangan has a tip for me.
Yes, I'm going to Tipperary. I'm keeping it local in the 640 Inchiquin Star for David Marnan and Wayne Lorden. Been a bridesmaid on a number of occasions. Hopefully tonight he'll get his time to shine.
Jane, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. My thanks to Rishi yesterday, who supplied us with a 10-1 winner on the podcast. More of that next week, please, Rish. Hope you're enjoying the coverage of Wimbledon as well. We will see you again tomorrow. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with Fitzdares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.